Good morning. May it please the Court. Mike Leonard on behalf of John Sullivan, and to the extent also on behalf of Daniel Sullivan, because some of these arguments are overlapping. And the largest issue that I'd like to address first is the loss amount. And if the Court recalls, the key to this and the trial judge's calculation was what was called Exhibit L, which was simply a listing of 20 to 30 individuals who had home repair work done on their homes, but it was done in the refinance context, meaning they took a loan out to pay for the work. And so the government's position at trial was that, and for sentencing purposes more importantly, is that everybody who's on this list who did this refi, their transaction must be fraudulent. And therefore, the court must take each one of those monetary amounts and calculate them for purposes of lost amount against the defendants. And that was a very flawed approach to this for many reasons. And really, the evidentiary backdrop to the whole case is completely contrary to the notion that every refi is a fraudulent transaction. There's really three or four witnesses that matter in the case on this issue. The government had an agent who put this exhibit in who simply said, I went through the financial records, I found the checks involving refi. For instance, Joe Smith did a refi for $100,000 and had work done on his home, et cetera, et cetera. That agent admitted he had no basis whatsoever to say that any of those transactions were fraudulent, that any of those transactions involved work that did not get done, or that any of the work associated with those transactions wasn't completed. And then the government put on two witnesses, essentially, the typical government witness con man who said, surprisingly, that I agree. The work done by this contractor, contractor.
The typical government witness con man, could you clarify that, please?
Yes. He was an individual who was admitted to be a drug addict, admitted on the stand that he lies.
Who was this? Who was it?
Oh, his name was Mr. Kelleher.
Okay.
He admitted even at trial that he could be expected to lie essentially about anything, including to his mother or to anybody else. But surprisingly, he testified that with regard to the work done by the Polish contractor that was listed in an Exhibit L, he thought the contractor actually did very good work. He could not point to any jobs that were fraudulent.
How could we believe him? Go ahead.
Sure. Well, let's say we don't believe him. The only other witness the government offered was Mr. Browning, who was the sales representative. His job was to go out to the homes to sign people up for work and essentially be the sales guy, to agree to terms upon which the work would be done. Mr. Browning admitted himself that the work done by the Polish contractor was of high quality, and he could not point to any jobs where he believed that what was bargained for was not given, with the exception perhaps of one job, which is one of the six that aren't included in this Exhibit L. So what we are left with was very individualistic testimony. The government, in their opening argument, sold the case as one in which we will present to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, a case in which the defendants get a consumer to get a refinancing transaction, get loan money. We'll show you that when the money comes in, they'll cut and run and not do the work. In fact, as the trial testimony showed, there were six examples put on, and it was turned out to be very individualistic. Some people got all the work they bargained for. Some people got 60%.
Who got all the work that they bargained for?
I think her name was Miss Love, Joyce Love.
Was she the one who was an employee of the defendants?
Correct, exactly. But it was very individualistic. As it turned out, it varied greatly from job to job. Some jobs might go on for weeks. Some jobs may take months. There'd be a lot of bickering and back and forth. But ultimately, the bottom line, which the government concedes in their brief, is with regard to Exhibit L, and those 20 or 30 people that added up to $1.2 or $1.3 million, there was not a shred of evidence about those jobs. There was not a shred of evidence that told us if the work was done or not done. So therefore, the conclusion by the trial court that we can simply assume that every one of those jobs was completely fraudulent and will charge the...
Go ahead, Your Honor. Was there any contrary evidence from the defense?
With regard to Exhibit L?
And the losses.
Correct. Well, there's two things. With regard to Exhibit L, we essentially took the position that we didn't call those people to say the work was done. But our position was it was their burden to show that any of the work wasn't completed. So we didn't call witnesses with regard to Exhibit L.
The answer is no.
With regard to Exhibit L, it's no. With regard to the other six people, so there's two buckets of loss, the people in Exhibit L and the six people that they called as witnesses at trial, which included, Your Honor, Ms. Love, also Ms. Thacker, Mr. Ray, and three others. With regard to them, we did vigorously contest the loss by pointing out in painstaking detail on cross-examination.
At trial.
All of the work that had been done. And in some instances, we were able to get a statement from the witness, essentially agreeing to an estimate of how much was done. For instance, one witness said, I think that was about 60%. Then, in our PSR, we took that same testimony, and where we laid out all the work that was done, the admissions of the consumers, and took a position with the trial court, okay, based upon that body of evidence and this particular individual, Your Honor, our position is that 75% of the work was done, therefore you need to credit.
How do you get 75% in light of the, is it Koterba? Mr. Koterba?
Yes.
Who testified, apparently he was the only subcontractor who did much of anything, and it wasn't much overall for the business.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that that's a fair representation, because if you looked at the individual victims who testified, by their own admissions, they went into great detail about what was actually done. So I think they're in a better position than him.
Are you telling us your clients should have been acquitted?
You should have been acquitted?
Mm-hmm.
We think so.
That's not part of your appeal.
It's not, Your Honor.
Okay.
The construct of assuming without any evidentiary basis that all jobs were bad in Exhibit L, and then coupled with the second bucket of loss, which is the six individuals, not making subtractions from their alleged loss amounts based upon the work actually form, was errored. And if you take those numbers away, you first take away Exhibit L, you get to about a figure of about $280,000, and then you make subtractions based upon the record from the 280, and our position would be the loss amount would be somewhere between $70,000 and $120,000.
So you would say that anything based on L isn't to be considered at all?
Anything based on what?
On Exhibit L?
Correct, because there's no factual record about any of those jobs. And what Mr. Koterba said, I think, is very important. So he testified that, and without rehabilitation by the government, that he's a craftsman. He takes pride in his work. He never knowingly engaged in any false transactions. And there's a big dispute about his testimony. If you look at it, the government says we're parsing it. I think, quite frankly, they're parsing it. There was a language barrier. He testified, and I think it's important for the court to look at what he said. They said to him, well, tell us about a typical project. How much do you make? And he definitely clearly had problems understanding what they meant. And he said to them, I don't understand typical project. He spoke in sort of clipped English. And eventually they got him to say, well, a typical project I might have made $8,000. On cross-examination, he admitted he couldn't really say how much money he ever made on one project. And they're not charged with, the defendants are not charged with overcharging people.
Was there reliable evidence of gross income and expenses of your clients' businesses?
There was definitely a detailed evidence submitted about what the defendants used their money for, where it went, what personal expenses they used it for. Is that what you mean?
I'm talking about trying to understand gross income and how much was paid in providing the services that were agreed.
Yes, I think there was pretty detailed evidence. On the one hand, the government submitted the bank records to show the total money that came in or should have come in, Your Honor. And then with regard to Mr. Koterba, evidence was presented that showed between himself and the materials that were used for the jobs he did, it was nearly $1 million.
Okay, and what was the gross?
I don't have that figure.
Okay. I guess my question really is whether the in considering the loss estimate, the government and the district, whether the district court can reasonably say, as near as we can tell, the entire business model is fraudulent.
I don't think they can. And I think that what it turned out to be is a very individualistic business, based upon not just what I'm saying, but based upon the two government witnesses who testified at trial about how the operation ran. And they were very clear, Browning and Kelher, that it was very individualistic about whether someone got the services they paid for or not. And I think the overall point here is the gentlemen were not charged with overcharging people. So let's say this court accepts the construct of, let's say this court says, well, $15,000 is a fair number. We think all the jobs on Exhibit L should have cost $15,000. Well, where does that take us? That doesn't show us that any of the work wasn't done. It just shows, if anything, that you, as a court, feel like they overcharged these people because $15,000 compared to $75,000 is too great of a disparity.
That's not what this is about.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Leonard. Mr. Carlson.
Please, the court. My name is Kent Carlson, and I was appointed to represent Daniel Sullivan in this case. I'm only going to talk today about the vulnerable victim enhancement. And I suggest that other than age, and putting Harold Ray aside for a moment, the district court offered no explanation or made any findings as to what characteristics made each of the victims unusually vulnerable or particularly susceptible.
Because they were old, they were in their 80s, but go ahead.
Well, Judge, and we'll take Harold Ray for an example. He was in his 50s. He was 52 years old.
Youngster, mere youth.
He was the victim of the stroke.
That's correct, Judge, and that was the only other fact that they
pointed to.
He took
advantage of his youth, but go ahead.
The only other factor they pointed to was that he had a stroke 2 years beforehand. There was no evidence presented that his stroke or his age in any way.
Was there evidence from the government witnesses that the defendants told them to target certain kinds of customers?
Judge, there was evidence that they were, and I think the quote that was used was the older the better, or the more ignorant the better, mm-hmm. along those lines. But there's nothing.
Why isn't that sufficient to support Judge Castillo's finding?
Well, first of all, two reasons. First of all, I think the judge has to make more specific findings than just to say those comments, because the record does not support that every single customer.
It doesn't have to. One victim is enough,
that's
right?
Correct.
For the two-level enhancement.
In you are correct, Your Honor. One victim is enough. But they don't point to any. They point, all the government points to is those statements, standing alone. They don't tie those statements to anything. If that were the case, and they presented evidence that, for example, Harold Ray or Richard Thomas and somehow was, in fact, ignorant, or was somehow impaired, that would be another story. But they didn't do that. What they said is just because, with the exception of Harold Ray, just because they're elderly, they're vulnerable. And I don't think you can make that jump. And with respect to Harold Ray, there's no evidence as to why his stroke makes him unusually vulnerable. We have two sitting United States senators who suffered strokes who are older than Harold Ray. And nobody would argue that they are unusually vulnerable.
Be careful. They might. Go ahead.
But I think what has to happen is there has to be more. There has to be some evidence that put it this way, Your Honor, merely saying that somebody's a member of a class is, I don't believe, is enough. If they're going
when you have testimony that these two defendants, John and Daniel Sullivan, told their assistants to target particular kinds of customers because they believed, the Sullivans believed, these would be more vulnerable, less likely to cause trouble, and insist on their rights. Why isn't that a reasonable inference to apply the two-level enhancement?
Because there is no evidence that these individuals fall within those classes. It would be, if the Sullivans had said that and they had come to me and said, take part, you know, do, let us sign you up. The mere fact that they came to, that the Sullivans believed that the more ignorant, the better, or the older, the better, The mere fact they came to me doesn't make me a vulnerable victim.
Mr. Carlson, would it make you less likely to sign a completion statement? Weren't they asked to target people who would willingly sign completion certificates?
Well, I think they did ask at least one person to sign such a statement, but I don't know that in and of itself is sufficient for that purpose.
Or got Thacker to sign documents in the lawsuit, got somebody else to sign over her house, right?
There were people who signed various documents, yes.
Various fraudulent documents presented by the defendants.
I suppose that they could be characterized.
They've been found guilty. You're not challenging the convictions.
I'm not. And I'm just saying that, in general, there were fraudulent documents that were involved. But the mere fact that these people were elderly doesn't mean that they would necessarily sign the documents just because they're elderly or just because they had had a stroke. And I think the government has to show that the defendants knew of the vulnerability and acted upon it. And I don't think that that's what we have here.
See, we don't have any evidence of targeting a group.
Well, no,
but
we don't.
You did.
It was.
You've got the testimony that these defendants told their assistants, the older the better, the more ignorant the better.
But there were also many other ways that the business operated. They had mass mailings. They had other things that were not directed towards and could not be directed towards the elderly or the ignorant, because some of them were just based solely on zip codes. So I don't think that broad statement is correct. I see that my time is up. If there's anything else, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Storino?
The court, my name is Timothy Storino, and I represent the United States of America in this case on appeal. I'd like to start with the loss analysis and walk the court through what the district court did in its loss analysis, and then specifically talk about some evidence that supported it. The district court found, specifically at page 59 and 60 of the sentencing transcript, that all refinancing projects entered into by the defendant during the time of the scheme to defraud from 2002 through 2006 fell within the scheme to defraud. That is the starting point of the loss analysis. From there, the district court turned and looked at the defendant's bank records. And looking at those bank records, the court identified refinancing deposits, specifically refinancing deposits that went into the defendant's business bank accounts. And what the court did was it eliminated from the loss analysis all refinancing deposits under $15,000 or refinancing deposits, multiple refinancing deposits to the same victim under $15,000. And the basis for that elimination was the testimony of the person, the subcontractor, the only subcontractor we talked about, Chris Koterva, who said that the maximum job he did on behalf of the defendants, he said, quote, up to $8,000. And as counsel points out, there was a language barrier. I believe his first language was Polish. And defense counsel raised this before the district court in response to the PSR and raised that the figure was not exact. And so what did the government do in response? In the PSR, the government set that amount at $8,000. In response to that, at sentencing, the government said, fine, we're going to raise that amount to $15,000. And by raising it to $15,000, which the district court agreed with, the government sought to do, and what the district court did, was ensure that any even arguable legitimate work that was completed by Mr. Koterva, the subcontractor, would be eliminated from the loss analysis. Any work he did that could even arguably be legitimate was not included in that loss analysis anymore by setting the threshold amount at $15,000. And even, frankly, that amount was high. the $8,000 figure testified by Mr. Kurturba, he used the words up to. And he didn't testify that he did multiple jobs for $8,000. And in fact, we've talked a little bit about one of the victims, Ms. Thacker, and that she testified that they did 60% of the work on her home. Mr. Kurturba testified that he did $4,000 to $5,000 worth of work on Ms. Thacker's home. She's signed a check in the amount of $63,000 to the defendants. There is no way that 60% of $63,000 is $4,000 to $5,000 worth of work. Now, the loss analysis, again, began with the refinancing proceeds, eliminated anything under $15,000. At that point, also, the district court credited to the defendants an offset for services performed under the application note, which was over the government's objection. And what the district court gave the defendants there was $8,000 per project. And again, that was based on Mr. Kuturba's testimony. Now, we've talked about the evidence and what evidence there was to support the district court's finding that all of the refinancing proceeds or all the refinancing projects entered into by the defendants were fraudulent. The place to start is the co-schemer's testimony, the testimony of Martin Kelleher, the testimony of Jim Brown. And if I may, Mr. Kelleher testified very clearly in the transcript at page 1477 in a letter that he wrote before he was ever approached by the FBI to an attorney who represented some of the victims. Mr. Kelleher said, quote, "The idea was to get elderly homeowners to sign credit applications and to refinance their homes, at which point the company would swoop in and get the refinance mortgage checks made out to their company, and then they would either do little or no work and pocket the money." That was his testimony. That is the place to start in terms of the evidence to support that these refinancing proceeds, refinancing deals, were a fraud. And his testimony, Mr. Browning's testimony, were supported by those six testifying victims. Not only those six victims' testimony, but the photographs that the government put in through those victims, which showed that little to no work was completed on those victims' homes. But another piece of evidence that supports the district court's finding that all the refinancing deals were a fraud was a notebook. And this is referred to before the district court as Government Exhibit Acorn Search Warrant 1. And I'll say that again. It's a bit complicated. And how we named our exhibits. Government Exhibit Acorn, A-C-O-R-N, S-W, Search Warrant 1. And that was a ledger or a notebook that was seized from John Sullivan's home. And the testimony was that Mr. Sullivan, John Sullivan, kept it at his place of business in his office. And if you look at the notebook, you'll see it's a ledger, and it's a list of all projects entered into by the defendants. Now, it is an incomplete list because it only covered part of the scheme to defraud. The scheme went from 2002 through 2006. It covered from approximately December 1st, 2004 through, I believe, August 30th, 2006. But when you look at it, you'll see there's a date, and then there's a name of a client, an address, a phone number, and then there would be work performed in a very simple way. And then there would be either an entry of cash or refi, and then an entry of amounts. Now, the vast majority in this notebook are, quote, cash jobs. And there's a small amount next to it, and there's a description of the work. Because that was the defendant's bread and butter. That's what they did. They were a cash home remodeling business. But where it says refi, where under the refi entries, there is no work listed next to it, and there is no amount listed next to it. And that supports the district court's finding that all the refis were a fraud. And this is why. Because they never intended to do any work, or they intended to do as little work as possible in order to appease the victims. In fact, one of the co-schemers testified that a phrase used around the office was, one nail, no jail. And that's in the transcript at page 395. And that meant, we'll do some work, we'll do a little bit of work, the defense got credit for it in the loss amount, but they'll only do enough to appease the victims, and hopefully they would, again, according to the defendants, forget, die, or give up. But going back to the other reason why the notebook supports the district court's finding that the refinancing deals were a fraud was there's no work listed, and then there's no amount. And that makes sense. There's no amount listed because when they entered into these deals with the victims, they had not gotten the refinancing proceeds yet. So there was no amount to be listed because they had to wait to see how much the bank was willing to give these victims. And in fact, in one case, Mr. Isaiah Pointer, one of the victims who testified in the case, he entered into a contract with defendants for $28,000 to refurbish his second and third floors. When he got refinancing proceeds for $45,000, Dan Sullivan came back to his home and said, by the way, the price has doubled. And unfortunately, Mr. Pointer gave him those proceeds as well. So the notebook also supports evidence that the refinancing deals were a fraud. And specifically, we've talked about victims who did not testify at trial. Four of the victims who did not testify at trial, Dallas Holman, Anna Richardson, Leon Sanders, and I believe Elmer Spragans, were all listed in the notebook as under the phrase refi with no amounts and no cashes next to it. One other piece of evidence to support the district court's finding was attached to the PSR. There were additional reports of interview of victims who did not testify. There were five of them. Again, I believe those were Charles Lucas, Curtis Carwell, Elmer Spragans, Floyd Nunn, and there was one more who I'm blanking on at the moment. But again, those reports of interviews, and again, they did not testify. Those were attached to the PSR. Those stories that they told were similar to the stories told by the victims who testified at trial. Some of them said that they did work. That's true. Floyd Nunn said they did absolutely no work. And I disagree with a point raised by counsel, which is they were not charged with overcharging. That's true, but overcharging was part of the scheme. It was part of the scheme because they never gave estimates to these victims. And they didn't give estimates on purpose because, like the example I gave with Mr. Pointer, because they didn't know how much the refinancing deals would be, and then they would come back and then charge them more. So overcharging was part of the scheme in this case. Your Honors, that is the evidence to support the loss analysis and the district court's finding that all refinancing proceeds were considered part of the scheme to the fraud. Specifically, the court only considered those above $15,000. If the court has no questions as to loss, I want to briefly address counsel's arguments regarding vulnerable victim. And a few points to make. Your Honor is correct. The defendants targeted these victims. They targeted, quote, elderly, ignorant homeowners, to use their words, transcript on page 355. And as defense counsel acknowledged, the more ignorant the better, quote, the older the better. That's in the transcript at page 351. So I think, counsel does make a point where he says that the initial mailings or the cold calls that went out to zip codes. And so I think counsel is saying that, of course, they didn't target people who were older or ignorant, to use their words, when sending out those mailings. That is, of course, true. However, that doesn't prohibit the enhancement from applying here because, as Your Honor pointed out, they did target this class of victim. And in the case cited by the government, United States v. Schneider, in that case, the court applied the enhancement, and actually, in that case, an accomplice brought the victim to the defendant's home. The court said, well, there's no requirement of targeting there. So the same would be true here in the sense that these victims responded to flyers and called the defendants. But the other point I would like to make in response to counsel's arguments that it was just age that the district court found is that in the sentencing transcript, the district court, at the end of the sentencing transcript, when discussing the 3553A factors, discussed how these victims were unique. And the judge discussed how they were the atypical fraud victims and how they were unsophisticated. And I think Your Honor started to get to this point towards the end of the discussion with a vulnerable victim, because some of the evidence was that, for example, Richard Thomas signed blank contracts that later came about to be, quote, completion certificates or contracts that he didn't engage in. Other defendants, Clementine Thacker, in fact, dictated a letter by John Sullivan to say, which absolved him of all wrongdoing. Again, I think what this shows, and I think what the court inferred, and which this court can as well, is that these victims were unsophisticated. And it is very much supported by the defendant's own words that they were, quote, seeking ignorant victims and elderly victims. With that, unless the court has any other questions, the government will rest on its briefs, and we ask that you affirm the defendant's.
Thank you, Mr. Storino. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Leonard, your time has expired, but you each may have an additional minute.
Very briefly, with respect to the loss amount, I think counsel has crystallized for this court very well what the issue is. As counsel said, Judge Castillo's starting point was his finding up front that every single refi job is per se fraudulent and no work was conducted. That crystallizes the issue for the court because that's what he found and everything flows from that. The problem is that there's only three witnesses who testified to that issue. Judge Castillo cannot simply say that he finds them to be per se fraudulent. There has to be evidence. There's not. There's a government agent who introduced Exhibit L who said there is no evidence about any of these jobs or them being fraudulent. There's Kelleher and asked the court to look at pages 467 to 469 of the trial transcript. He was the star witness. He said Katerba did high-quality work, great craftsmanship, etc., etc. Final witness was Browning. Those are the only three people that Judge Castillo could hang his hat on to come up with this per se unreasonable argument. It's not there. Browning was the sales rep. He did not in any way testify that all refis were fraudulent. Exactly to the contrary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Mr. Carlson?
I'll rest on our
feet. All right. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. And, Mr. Carlson, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment. All right. The case is taken under advisement.